Welcome to the Capital Connection, a weekly program questioning New York State leaders on a variety of issues. Your host is Dr. Alan Chartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Support for the Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, a union of professionals standing with more than 600,000 workers in education, human services, and healthcare with the Our Voice, Our Values, Our Union campaign. And United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.
It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us this week is Jesse McKinley, the Albany Bureau Chief of the New York Times. Welcome back, Jesse. Always great to hear from a guy I consider a personal hero, and we're delighted you're here.
Thank you, Alan. I appreciate that.
Okay, so let's talk, first of all, about the Mueller report and the Southern District of New York. Tish James, the attorney general, has made it clear that she has some things to say about him and that there are going to be investigations into President Trump. Can you sort of praise the whole thing for us?
Well, you know, I think that everyone at this point is kind of waiting to actually read the report and figure out what it actually says. I think the summary that Barr released was 4 pages. One would hope that the Mueller report is longer than that. So I think until people actually get their hands on the report, which I think will eventually happen either through leaks or through actual public release, it's going to be difficult to determine what sort of legal steps are going to be taken. I mean, certainly Tish James does have some ancillary jurisdiction here, obviously it being New York State. I think certainly the Southern District has enormous jurisdictional rights to look at the president. But I think until we see the report, until people are actually able to read it and parse it, I would not hold your breath for any sort of major action until that happens.
So Tish James, of course, is somebody who is closely aligned with Governor Cuomo. And so my question to you is, do you think the two of them are acting in tandem when she goes after Trump? Because he seems to be laying back a little bit on the Trump issue.
I wouldn't be surprised if that was happening per se. You know, certainly Tish James has a relationship with the governor. The governor was critical to her election as attorney general. But those are independent bodies, obviously, and they both act, you know, on their own accord. I mean, that being said, New York is a solidly Democratic state. Its political leadership, its top political leadership, often are in sync, you know, on issues where it pertains to the federal government. And Cuomo has been, you know, repeatedly, almost ad nauseum, attacking the Trump administration, particularly for the SALT deduction cap. And, you know, I don't see that he's backing off Trump per se, but I think Tish James, being a new person in office, is probably trying to make her, you know, put her stamp on that role as Attorney General. And that may seem to be kind of coordinated because, of course, Cuomo is continually trying to attack Trump and blame him for the state's fiscal problems.
Now, Jesse McKinley, I've been writing a little bit about the fact that every time I talk to Cuomo, which is increasingly prolific, I sense that the guy is setting himself up to be president. I mean, some of it is pretty self-serving. I mean, he said to me the other day, you know, a lot of people are running, but they don't have any experience, and they haven't run in a major governmental body or whatever, he said. And that, of course, led me to ask him, but it sounds like you're talking about yourself. But there doesn't seem to be a slot for him. It's like going to the airport, but the airplane can't find a slot to go into. Is this just like his father? In other words, every time Mario talked about or hinted about running for president, his numbers went up. Do you think there's something to that?
Well, I think we've had this conversation before. I mean, I think that at this point, I certainly don't think Andrew Cuomo is running for president. But that being said, as you point out sagely, you know, he does certainly have a, you know, he has enough accomplishments and enough kind of things he can point at in terms of his record, whether it be the minimum wage or same-sex marriage or paid family leave or things like that, that would allow him to, you know, submit a pretty credible case that he could run certainly the state of New York and perhaps kind of a larger executive branch such as the federal government. Now, that being said, I think right now politically speaking, his kind of slot, as it were, that lane that he would be running in is kind of firmly occupied by Joe Biden, who seems to be very intent on running for president, has basically suggested that he is running, and has a relationship, a friendship, I think, with Andrew Cuomo that would kind of prevent Mr. Cuomo, the governor, from pursuing the higher office. Also, to differ with you, I'm not completely sure that the governor has the thirst for that. You know, he seems to be very comfortable being governor. He seems to know Albany. He obviously knows where the levers of powers are. He knows everyone's kids' names. He's been in this, you know, fishbowl for 40 years. You know, I don't necessarily see him, you know, dropping that to run off to Washington, D.C. Now, once again, to offer another, like, Tevye-like caveat, if perhaps that lane were to open, if Biden were not to run, if the Democrats were to be devoid of a credible candidate, would he maybe entertain such a thought? Absolutely, I think.
I don't think we're on different pages on that, by the way. I think you're exactly right. It seems to me he has three places to go. He could go to his father's old office at Wilkie Farr and sit in the corner office and make rain after this term is over. He could run for president, maybe, as we're suggesting, if something opened up. Or he could run for a fourth term, which was denied to his father. And he has an interesting thing with his father. It's both competitive but loving. So which of those three do you pick?
I mean, if I was pressed, I would say the third. I would say that there is... you know, I would think that, you know, there's a kind of a little bit of a Albany wag joke going around the Legislative Correspondents Association where people say four more terms. You know, there is a sense that he has found the perfect job for himself and may have no intention of leaving anytime soon. So of the three, you know, if he continues to, you know, bounce above 50% in 2022, which is a, you know, eons away, politically speaking, if he were to be popular enough to kind of carry into a fourth term, I could see that happening. By the same token, I could certainly see him saying, okay, three terms is enough, 12 years is enough, let someone else do the job. But, you know, once again, he will not be an old man at that point. He'll be in his mid-60s. Conceivably, he could, you know, go for a fourth, which would certainly be Shakespearean in that he would try to accomplish something that his father had not.
Yeah, exactly. Now, Wilkie Farr is interesting in that one of the managing partners or former managing partners, I have to just mention this, that's the firm Mario worked in for our listeners after he left the governorship. It was one of the guys who got caught up in the great college admissions scandal. This has no bearing on anything, so you'll just excuse me for the diversion, okay?
We'll just footnote that. That's fine. Thank you for noting.
So, talk to me about congestion pricing.
Well, it seems as though earlier this week that the Assembly, which had long been the kind of stumbling block for, you know, kind of legislative approval of this, you know, Carl Hastie came out on Monday and said that he apparently had gotten to 76 votes, which, of course, is the critical number in the Assembly, it being 150-seat chamber. He had gotten the 76 people to say, okay, let's go with this. And then in later interviews said, I think I'll have even more votes than that. He feels fairly confident that he can get some sort of plan through his chamber. The Senate has, you know, already said that they support some sort of plan, and obviously the governor has been banging the drum on this for several weeks. So you've got the three parts that you need to make a law. Now, that being said, this being Albany, this being budget season, you know, there is a lot of trips between lip and cup. So things can go south relatively quickly here. I think there have been reports, obviously, this week that the pied de terre tax, which seemed to be kind of a solid part of the budget, may be transforming into some sort of transfer tax, which would not actually be a pied de terre tax. It would be more like a just kind of different real estate tax. So things can change in Albany, and they can change quickly, but at least for the time being, congestion pricing looks to be headed to New York City, and it would be the first city in the United States to have a plan whereby if you drive in the lower Manhattan, any place under 60th Street, you know, you will be dinged you know, somewhere in the neighborhood of $11-$12 simply for driving into Lower Manhattan, which will probably make people think twice about driving into Lower Manhattan, particularly if you're living on a budget. So.
And everybody wants an exemption. I see that there's at least one character who wants legislator who says, okay, we'll have congestion pricing, but not if you're a citizen of New York City. That's pretty funny. So, of course, you get guys like Weprin in Queens who are saying, I don't want my people to pay for coming into Manhattan.
Yeah, I feel like certainly there are going to be exemptions. But one thing that struck me in Carl Hastie's remarks on Monday was he said, look, if you carve out too many things, if you make too many exemptions here, that's going to cut into the revenue. And you know, it's a fine balance, right? You do obviously want to be cognizant of, say, people with disabilities having an exemption from this, or people who are delivering medical supplies or cases of emergency or things like that. Obviously, you don't want to ding people who are doing their jobs. But by the same token, you do need to maximize revenue so that you can then sell bonds against that revenue, right? And at the end of the day, that's what we're talking about here. They're, you know, they estimate upwards, you know, somewhere in the $15 billion range for bonds, and that money would go to largely to trying to fix the New York City subways, but also, you know, some money for commuter rail as well. So, you know, it's a delicate balance between, you know, carving out stuff for people that are worthy of exemptions and, of course, trying to get as much money in the coffers as possible.
We're talking to Jesse McKinley, the reporter, along with his colleagues on the New York Times. So let's go back to pied-à-terre. I'm very interested in this. So what is it that has made that turn from a pied-à-terre tax on the richest of the rich into a different kind of transfer real estate tax?
Well, I think that there obviously is going to be behind the scenes pressure. You know, I think that obviously the real estate lobby in New York State is a giant, powerful, and rich lobby that has probably been working the phones, you know, and telling people that this could conceivably cool the market for high-end properties, that it could kill the golden goose that is New York City's real estate market. And, you know, that could be true. That could be spin. But whatever it is, I would not be surprised if REBNY, the Real Estate Board of New York, has been working the phones pretty hard on this. Also, you know, I think that any sort of tax in this day and age, even if it is a tax on high earners, is not particularly popular. I think sometimes that can be a hard sell. So we shall see where that actually ends up. At this point, it seems like it is a little bit more tenuous than it was a week or two ago.
Speaking about tenuous, let's go to marijuana. Let's smoke a little marijuana.
What a segue. Beautiful. You are a pro, Alan. What a segue.
So in New Jersey, they thought they had it and it collapsed. New York State, the governor, I think, thought he had it in the beginning, but now he's talking as if it's not going to happen, at least in the budget. What do you make of it?
Well, I think, you know, there's a number of theories going on here. You know, I think there are legitimate concerns being raised in some quarters that it's a big change. It's, you know, marijuana is still illegal under federal law. I think that states that have legalized, particularly California, you know, where they had been promised $1 billion worth of tax revenue, that has fallen well short. I think they only got $350 million in their first year of legalization. I think there are a lot of moving parts, and we have obviously reported on the fact that low-income communities and communities of color really want this sort of program to address not only criminal justice inequities, but also, you know, community inequities that have arisen over the years as a result of current drug policies. So there are a lot of moving pieces here, and a lot of these are complicated issues, you know. So once these start to all kind of move in tandem or not move in tandem or grind up against one another, it does take time. And right now, particularly in New York, you know, the budget is due on April 1st. That is super soon.
And
April Fool's Day, which is never without noting. But it's a lot of details to kind of get ironed out by that deadline. And I think that for legislators, they are less concerned with you know, pushing it into the budget. And Cuomo seems to say, well, if it's not in the budget, it's basically not going to happen. You know, I'm not necessarily sure that's going to happen, but certainly the budget is an inflection point. It is a moment, a deal-making moment, where a lot of stuff can get shoved in there. But, you know, right now it's touch and go as to whether or not it'll make that deadline.
Hey, are we going to be able to gamble in New York, put a little money down on some sports betting or on a casino around 42nd Street, which is where I bet it would go? There's a lot of talk now about bringing casino to New York when it was supposed to be upstate.
Well, let's be clear. I mean, part of the problem here is that if you want to place a bet in New York, you probably can. It won't be legal, but
you got to go to the bar. Yeah.
Yeah, you got to know a guy.
And you can't tax it, right?
Yeah, exactly. You got to know a guy. But honestly, I mean, part of what's going on here is twofold. One is obviously the sports betting part of this, which Cuomo has voiced support for, but in a limited fashion, which is that he only wants, you know, sports betting halls inside of four casinos in upstate New York. And if you talk to casino owners and casino lobbyists, they say that's a pittance. You know, that's not really going to make very much money. A lot of those casinos are far afield. They're difficult to get to. People don't, you know, aren't going to, you know, it might be an amenity for a place like Rivers Casino in Schenectady, but it's not going to, you know, draw billions and billions of dollars into the coffers. Now, what they say will make money is mobile sports betting, which is what they have in New Jersey. But the governor seems very, very cold on that.
I'm sorry, I missed that. What is mobile sports betting?
Mobile essentially means that you could pick up your cell phone, and if you're in the state of New York, you could, you know, fire up an app and place a bet on the Knicks, although I would not bet on the Knicks. You might bet against the Knicks, but you probably wouldn't bet on the Knicks. And that's the sort of system they have in New Jersey where, you know, you can, so long as you're inside of the state of New Jersey, you can place bets on your phone. But Cuomo seems cold on that. And then the second part of this would be an expansion of casinos, which I think is a long shot in the budget, but could happen and probably will happen at some point in the next couple of years where casinos will start to creep up either in the city proper or right on the edges, you know. And part of that has been long by design, but I think there's a sense that that could be a very big pot of money that the state could tap into, both through the issuing of licenses, which would be, you know, $500 million or something like that per casino, as well as a take from the tax revenues.
We're talking to Jesse McKinley of the New York Times. So, Jesse, I guess the next question has to do with the circular firing squad. You know, the Democrats take the Senate with or without Cuomo's help. There's some discussion of that. Let's give him a little credit for it and say he tried to help. But now he's angry at them and they're angry at him. And there's a whole bunch of stuff going on. Is that going to be resolved or not?
Well, you know, I think it goes up and down. It's kind of a roller coaster. You know, I think that the animosity between the executive branch and the legislative branch had kind of gotten pretty fierce, particularly after the Amazon deal fell apart.
Right.
Cuomo obviously blamed the Senate for that, blamed Michael Gennaris in particular for that, and you know was throwing about some throwing shade, as they say, on the Senate and back and forth. You know, both sides were kind of calling each other out. I feel like the temperature there has decreased a little bit. I feel like they are trying to work towards a budget at this point. I noted that on a couple of days ago that Cuomo was basically invited by, I think, Alan Chartok to take a swing at the Senate and declined to. Said, oh, yes, we're working pretty well. So I think that they are at least trying to play nice. Whether or not that continues all the way to the budget deadline, we shall see. I would bet that there will be a few more bumps in the road, though, if I know as well as you do.
Now, as I remember it, if the budget is not arrived at on time, and the governor seems to hint from time to time that he gets his way or the highway, then the legislature loses, as I remember the deal, their pay raise, which I think is number one preeminent in their thinking.
Yes. Well, you know, they would certainly deny that, saying that, you know, the money is, and then, you know, is an important thing. But certainly that is the reality, that if they don't get a budget on time, that they do not get their pay raise. And for some lawmakers, that could be a fairly significant hit. Now, that being said, I think, you know, as well as I do, that the the budget in New York State tends to fall apart about six or seven times before it eventually comes together. And I've covered enough of these to know, you know, it seems like disaster looms. And then, of course, they pull it out of the fire at the last minute. So I would suspect this goes right up to the edge of oblivion, and then they probably pull it back. Although the governor certainly has leverage in the fact that if it is late, yes, the lawmakers won't get their bump in salary. So
we know that Donald Trump and the press have a really bad relationship, and the press has to fight back. We all know that. What's Trump's general relationship with the press looking like these days?
Well, that's a broad question. I mean, he has certainly taken up to calling the media the enemy of the people again, which I find to be a really kind of dangerous term to be throwing around, particularly after the Mueller report came out and the president was exonerated, at least of the collusion element of this. I think there was a lot of victory lapping going on in that administration, and certainly some consideration in media circles as to whether or not the story had been overplayed or not. I mean, I'm not going to put out an opinion on that because that's not my job. But, you know, I do think that the New York Times and every journalistic colleague I know does their job honestly and fairly and tries to report the truth, you know, and, you know, politics be damned. And so to criticize the media is legitimate and fair, but to castigate them and to demonize them, I feel is not. So that's my two cents.
What about Cuomo?
Yeah, I think Cuomo's relationship with the media has actually improved quite a bit this year. I think last year during the election campaign, it kind of hit a low watermark. I think that there was a lot of, obviously there was a lot of hard coverage of him and coverage of Cynthia Nixon that he probably felt was unfair. But I think he has made an outreach, and I think particularly because of the kind of Democratic monopoly in New York State, he has been much more accessible to the media. He's held at least a dozen red rooms, I think, this year to push various causes. He has been, very active talking to you and talking to Brian Lehrer and talking to other people in a way that he was not so much last year during the campaign, or at least during a political year or a reelection year. So his relationship with the media obviously ebbs and flows like any politician's, but at this moment he seems to be certainly much more accessible to the media. Whether or not he's liking the coverage he's getting, you'd have to ask him.
I only got 2 minutes, but I wanted to ask you real quick, Joe Prococo, Todd Howe, on the way to the slammer, or at least Prococo is, Howe may get off a little bit now. It's amazing to me that none of this has stuck to the governor.
Well, Prococo actually has reported, but, you know, you're right. It did not seem to leave any kind of permanent political mark on the governor, despite, obviously, Joe Prococo being, as the governor described him, a member of his family. Todd Howe was a little bit further afield, but certainly someone that the governor had trusted in the past. And you're leaving out Elaine Calleros, who, of course, was his, like, economic guru, who was also headed to prison. But in all these cases, that has not seemed to leave any lasting damage. And it's something that, you know, you remark upon again and again when you're covering New York State politics, is that voters say in polls over and over, you know, corruption's a huge problem, corruption's a huge problem, corruption's a huge problem. But then at the end of the day, they don't really necessarily vote that way unless it's, you know, the house is literally on fire as they're walking to the ballot box. So it's a peculiarity, you know, it's a paradox that the voters seem to say that they care about corruption, but they don't necessarily connect that with Governor Cuomo or necessarily any politician.
Well, he handled it well, I think, Jesse, and this is going to have to be my last word because we have to go, but he handled it well, and he said it was a great personal disappointment to me, and people bought it. They said yes.
Yes, they seem to. And he did have plausible deniability that he certainly did not know anything about it, and the prosecutors never said that he did. So, you know, he seemed to be in the clear in that regard.
It's been a wonderful conversation. Jesse McKinley of The New York Times, we are extraordinarily grateful that you bless our airwaves with being on, and you know so much, and we all appreciate it.
Well, thanks so much.
The Capital Connection is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. David Gustina is the producer of The Capital Connection. Support for The Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, a union of professionals standing with more than 600,000 workers in education, human services, and healthcare with the Our Voice, Our Values, Our Union campaign. And United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State, Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.